Good evening, gentle folk. That time is upon us. When the spirits rise from the grave, evil lurks the corners. This is the Common Spooking Program.
Oh, shit.
Wait a minute. That podcast hasn't been aired for 40 years. Whoa!
I forgot about that joke.
We are a book club or common reading program for geek culture.
Boogity boogity.
In each episode, we choose a topic that four people will discuss from their own perspectives. The scariest thing of all, in-depth analysis.
I'm pretty sure the scariest thing of all is the hash-slinging slasher.
The sash-ringing, the trash-slinging, mash.
In this episode, we have...
Hey, I'm Jeff. I'm dressed up like an Umbreon right now, but you can't see that because this is only audio. And in this episode, I'm going to be repping the classic, The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Woo! And I am Edward Ryan. I'm dressed as a ghost, and no one can prove that I'm not because my video is turned off. And for this spooptacular episode, I will be representing Halloween 3, The Season of the Witch.
Wow, I was not expecting that.
Classic film.
And I am Patrick Brem. I am dressed up as a mouse. Duh.
I don't get it.
You never seen Mean Girls?
Oh. Yeah, it's been so long.
Anyway, I am representing Guillermo del Toro's masterpiece, Pan's Labyrinth.
Mean Girls.
Yo, wait, can you imagine Guillermo del Toro's Mean Girls?
Guillermo del Toro.
That would be hilarious.
And, dear listeners, I am your host, Taimul, or as the creatures of the night call me, Chowder.
Are you saying that we have to be creatures of the night to prefer that, then?
No, it's just that the creatures of the night prefer that. It's like squares and rectangles. All creatures of the night call him Chowder, but not all that call him Chowder are creatures of the night.
I understood.
And for this Halloween spectacular, we will be discussing the Cartoon Network 2014 miniseries, Over the Garden Wall.
I was not prepared for this Fields trip, I'm just saying that right now.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty spicy.
Fan-fucking-tastic.
I love it.
So Over the Garden Wall, as stated before, it was a miniseries made by Cartoon Network. It was made by
it's so good.
Patrick McHale, who before that was known for being one of the creative directors on Adventure Time.
And The Misadventures of Flapjack, right?
Yes, that too.
Dude, you know what? I thought it had a Flapjack-y kind of feel to it.
Yeah, it was kind of like halfway in between Adventure Time and Flapjack in terms of like tonal creepiness.
Tone, yeah, yeah.
I would say.
Yeah. Anyway, so... Yeah, Over the Garden Wall follows these two brothers, Wirt and Greg, as they get lost in the woods.
And Wirt is voiced by Elijah Woods.
Yeah.
How the fuck did he go from Lord of the Rings to Spy Kids to this? Like,
okay, because Elijah Wood did Lord of the Rings. And
Elijah
he had
Wood
enough
was in
money.
Spy Kids?
Yeah,
Spy yeah, he's
Kids
the guy 3. In Spy Kids 3D.
Oh, shit! He is the guy! Oh, fuck.
More importantly, Elijah Wood did Lord of the Rings, and then he was set for life. So he was like, what would be fun to do? And then that's the rest of his career.
It's just yep. Insane, dude.
Anyway, so Over the Garden Walls.
Yeah. So, you know, you got these two brothers, Wirt and Greg. They end up lost in the woods called the Unknown. And we follow them as they try to get back. Along the way, they meet characters like the Woodsman and a blue jay named... Beatrice.
She's a bluebird, excuse me. Blue jays have a crest on their head. Get your bird facts straight, Chowder.
Yeah, it's a blue bird. They say it. Taimul, come on.
And Beatrice is probably my favorite character.
Beatrice was pretty great.
She's so full of sass.
Yeah.
Greg, don't you want to be more like your brother? Just always doing what you're told?
Huh?
Just a pathetic pushover who relies on others to make all his decisions?
Hey, what? I'm not a pushover.
Hold on, Wirt. Let me get to my point.
Fine.
See, Greg? No willpower whatsoever.
Okay, spoiler alert for those who haven't seen the show, but...
Oh, we're going to spoil the whole thing.
Yeah, we're going to spoil the whole thing. So if you are planning to watch Over the Garden Walls, stop this right now. Go watch it. Then come back here.
It's so good. We should say that it's a 10 episode miniseries, and each episode is only 10 minutes. So it only takes like 100 minutes to watch.
There you go, buddy.
Yeah, that's actually about the length of a movie, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, so now that the warning has been done, we later find out that the unknown is sort of purgatory for all who go there. Anyone who is near death go there, and if they find themselves lost in these woods, they don't come back to the living.
And there's this guy named the Beast who, like, tries to take the lost souls and turn them into Edelwood trees and use them to burn his lantern.
Yeah.
He's the antagonist.
Yeah. And that's where the woodsman comes in. You know, the woodsman
is the keeper of the lantern.
Oh, yeah. We should. So there's a woodsman, and he's chopping down some trees. And the brothers, they come across him, and they're like, oh, hey, can you help us and not chop us up with your axe? And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll help you, and I won't chop you up with my axe. And so he takes them to this mill house. Not the character from The Simpsons, like a house that has a mill. And then the Beast attacks, and it's this crazy wolf monster with big, crazy eyes. And it destroys the whole mill house, but they defeat it.
They sort of get themselves into that trouble because, like, the quote-unquote Beast, because we find out at the end of the episode that that dog is actually not the Beast. It's just another thing that exists in this forest.
It was being possessed by the Beast.
Sort of, yeah. I guess the turtles are
it
sort
was,
of...
It was, because it had the eyes of the Beast. It was definitely being possessed by the Beast.
It wasn't being possessed. It was because it ate one of the black turtles. And the reason that it ate the black turtle is because Greg had a bunch of candy and was just putting it on shit to leave a trail.
Making a reference to Hansel and Gretel, yeah.
Yeah, and he puts this piece of candy on a turtle that he sees. And then at the end of the episode, the reason that the dog is all evil is because he ate this turtle because Greg put the candy on it. So the entire time, the dog's not even trying to eat them. It's just trying to get the candy that Greg has.
That's true.
Yeah, so the thing about Over the Garden Wall is that its art style and its overall aesthetic is based around kitschy Americana, 19th century folk art.
So great.
It's got a very Halloween-y kind of vibe because, like, it's got all these autumn tones, drab oranges and browns and stuff. It's got pumpkins and shit.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly creepy, so.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of thrives on that whole, like, creepy and sort of charming at the same time aesthetic.
Yeah.
It's very Halloween-y.
And yeah, so it's the perfect thing for Halloween.
And then they meet a talking bird named Beatrice. Well, they save Beatrice's life from a bush that she's sort trapped of. In. And then Beatrice is like, I have to help you now. I'll take you to...
Adelaide, the good woman of the pasture.
Yeah, and she'll help you get home. And they're like, great.
So slowly we find out that while we're bonding with Beatrice, we start to find out that the reason that she's luring them to Adelaide is because Adelaide's not good, she's actually evil. And Beatrice was cursed because she threw a rock at a bluebird and her entire family got turned into bluebirds.
Little overreactive there, like the entire family.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
It's a big family. Also, when we found out that Beatrice was leading them to Adelaide to, like, be eaten or whatever.
Yep.
Yeah.
Fucking, that was top 10 anime betrayals right there.
Oh my god.
But we learned this through the fact that, like, we kind of see Beatrice get more and more regret as the series goes on because she actually starts to like Wharton Greg. So she's not bad, per se. She's just was trying to fix her family.
All I know is I am never going back till I can make them human again. I'd do pretty much anything.
No, and she helps them escape from Adelaide.
Yeah. And there's lots of great shit happens. There's this frog that Greg is carrying around the entire time who gets, like, a different name each episode.
He will eventually be known as Jason Thunderberker.
Because he's named after another character. Jason Thunderberker, the best character in this entire fucking show.
That guy's got his act together. He's the total package. I can't compete.
He is 110 pounds of pure man.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. We should go listen to this mixtape.
He's got his shit together, all right?
There is poetry and clarinet on that tape, Greg.
Poetry and clarinet!
So the whole story is kind of about Wirt's insecurities and how he's sort of like...
Yeah, surprisingly, at its core, It's a coming of age story.
Relatable. Yeah.
Hashtag relatable.
Because like the whole reason that they're in this mess to begin with, we find out in episode 9, it shows us a flashback of how they got into this scenario. It was Halloween and Wirt had this tape that he was going to give to this girl. But then he found out that his supposed nemesis, Jason Thunderbirker, who we were led to sort of believe that he's like a big jock.
I feel like we were led to believe that he was like some sort of jock because when he first comes up, it's at like a football game and everything. Yeah. And, you know.
And it turns out Jason Thunderbirker is actually this huge dweeb. And
hey, Sarah, are you ready to go?
Hey, Jason Thunderbirker.
Oh, hey, Wirt. Let's go, Sarah.
You coming, Wirt?
No, you go. Have fun with Jason Thunderbirker.
And Wirt's insecurities run much deeper than any of us could have suspected.
Wirt's just very insecure.
So, through trying to avoid conflict, him and Greg end up going over this wall, and then that's how the whole thing happens.
So, after the top 10 anime betrayal of Beatrice, right, Wirt and Greg and whatever the fuck the frog's name was at the time.
It was either George Washington or Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah, so they go off on their own. They run into this crazy demon chick who tries to eat them, and then they, like, use a bell to save her soul from this witch.
Yeah, Her name was Lorna.
Yo, fucking, in the opening sequence of the show, there's a fucking shot of Lorna sorting bones, and I was just like, I never noticed that before.
Yeah.
This show is crazy.
Dude, that was probably top 20 anime betrayals. Oh my god. All right,
so they save this chick's soul from, like, a weird demon, and then they keep going on their merry way, and eventually they get stuck in, like, a snowstorm. Wirt is real pissed at Greg, and he decides to, like, go to sleep.
And sad about Beatrice betraying them.
Yeah. Essentially, they end up, like, splitting up, and Greg goes off on his own with the beast to save Wirt's soul, I guess.
Yeah. But, unfortunately, Greg ends up turning into one of the trees.
So, well, hold on. You're missing a very big part of this. The beast gives him tasks to go do. He has him find, like,
a golden comb and a spool of silver
thread, which he comes back with a honeycomb and a spool of spider web.
It's just spider web on a stick.
Because Greg is creative.
And then he tasks him with catching the sun in a cup.
Now I want the sun.
The sun?
Here. Lower the sun out of the sky and into this china cup.
And Greg is so clever and creative that he's just like, I'm gonna put this cup on this tree stump.
Yeah, that's it.
And the sun is gonna fall into the cup. And then the beast is like, you figured it out. Yes, now fall asleep and I'm gonna steal your soul. And then the woodsman comes with his lantern and we find out that in the lantern is the beast's soul.
We've been led to believe throughout the entire series that inside the woodsman's lantern is not the beast's soul, but the woodsman's daughter's soul. And then the only way that he can keep it lit is basically by doing what the beast wants him to do, which is letting souls die in the wood and then chopping down the Edelwood trees.
Yeah, and like, you know, when it looks like Greg's gonna die and Wirt's all desperate, the beast makes him an offer.
I can put his spirit in the lantern. As long as the flame stays lit, he will live on inside. Take on the task of lantern bearer, or watch your brother perish.
It was at that moment Wirt was like, just
I love that moment.
Real clever in that moment where he's like,
Wirt had his moments, you know?
He did.
Like, he was an insecure, kind of whiny bitch a lot of the time, but
he eventually stopped being an asshole and, like, when push come to shove, he pulled through.
He was pretty clever, yeah.
Theoretically, he was still an asshole in that moment because he was like, why would I spend all my time in the woods just to save my brother's soul? That's stupid.
No. I think he was calling the beast bluff.
Yeah, basically what happens is, like, how do I know you're not bullshitting me on this?
It's almost like your soul is in this lantern.
And the beast is like, oh shit, fuck.
Beast is like, no, it's not.
It was great, because Wirt was just like, yo, fuck your tragic cyclical ending.
He eventually gives the woodsman the lantern. He's like,
I've got my own problems to take care of. This one's yours.
Yeah, he really calls the beast's bluff when he threatens to blow out the lantern. The beast is like, no, shit!
Yeah, and, you know, the woodsman, like, actually blows out the light, and we see that Wirt and Greg eventually make it out of the unknown, where it gets everyone out of the river. And
yeah, well, so the thing is, when they go over the garden wall before the series starts, and we see it in episode 9, they fall into this river.
You're sinking like a stone before.
And they're, like, drowning, and then when they beat the beast, Wirt, like, wakes up inside the river and pulls Greg out, and then they go to the hospital. So it's sort of like they were in the river the whole time, and it's, like, it's supposed to be not quite clear how much of it was actually real.
Insert Inception noise there.
Well, I think they're pretty on the side of that was real, because when, like, Greg's, like, shaking...
Yeah, he still has the bell.
Shaking Jason Thunderbirker, the frog's, like, glowing with the bell inside, and...
Yeah, the bell that he ate in the episode with Lorna.
Yeah.
So what happened?
Alright, listeners, now begins the domains!
Bum bum bum!
I thought someone had like a Halloween soundboard.
I did.
Why aren't you using it?
I'm playing it! I just played it!
Did you? Oh, dude, it's not loud.
Yeah.
Okay, Patrick, don't bitch about the sound. There! You happy?
Yeah, why are you hitting Pat with the Patricks tonight?
We're gonna start calling you Taimu. See how you like it.
Yeah, man, like... What the fuck?
Alright, anyways. The domains. Jeff?
Oh, okay. What an intro. Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Jeff. This week I'm repping The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Who?
The Nightmare Before Christmas is a movie apparently made in 1993, which is a lot older than I thought it was, by Tim Burton.
Dude, that movie's older than you, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. You too.
Like, all he's of older us. Than all
okay,
of
but
us.
We're not talking about me, okay?
Not older than Laura.
Yeah, Laura's old as fuck.
She's an old man.
So, The Nightmare Before Christmas is a stop-motion animation film, the plot of which is very spooky.
Not directed by Tim Burton.
Yeah,
produced by Tim Burton, directed by,
some other guy.
Wait, no, The Nightmare Before Christmas was totally directed by Tim Burton. It was The Corpse Bride that wasn't directed by Tim Burton.
Look that shit up.
I got it. You keep talking, I'm looking this up, okay?
Okay. I'll trust
look
Pat.
Look it up, Pat.
Anyway, so the premise of the movie is that
Henry Selick, piece of shit, motherfucker.
Oh, shit. Okay. Well, I fucked up. But still, it's based on a poem that Tim Burton wrote.
Yeah, Tim Burton was clearly, like, a major player in this movie. He wasn't, like, one of those producers that just puts his name on it.
He did put his name on it, though. Like, literally, it's called Disney's Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
He did put his name on, I'm saying, but he didn't just put it on. He was a contributor. It's his aesthetic.
Yeah. So there's these holiday towns, right? And the main character is Jack Skellington, who is kind of the figurehead of Halloween Town. He's got sort of this like existential angst where like he's really good at being spoopy, but he's kind of bored by just doing the same thing over and over again.
Yet year after year, it's the same routine, and I grow so weary of the sound of screams.
He kind of walks off into the woods, and he finds all these portals to the other holiday towns, and he goes into the door to Christmas Town. And he's really excited about like all the new aesthetics. He's pretty pumped about Christmas, and he's just like, hey, everything's not about scaring shit. This is kind of like a cool new thing to do.
As the kids would say, it was lit.
Yeah, we're...
With Christmas lights.
So he brings back his discovery to Halloween Town, and he's trying to explain it to all of his Halloween friends, and they're all just not getting it. They're like, I don't understand. There's presents? Is there, like, an evil monster in those presents? Or, like...
They just don't comprehend Christmas.
And he's just like, no, there's just something pleasant in here. And they're just like, why would you do that? So then he swings it, and he's just like, I'll get them to appreciate it, but I gotta do it in a way they'll understand. So he starts, like... telling about how terrifying Christmas is, and he's just like, oh, and there's like a giant red monster.
And they call him Sandy Claus.
Sandy Claus.
So he convinces them to like Christmas, but he's still pretty upset that they're not really getting the whole Christmas spirit, and he wants to do his own Christmas, so he has some little henchmen kidnap Santa Claus, and they're making this, like, weird amalgamation of Halloween and Christmas, and everything is terrifying, and then he dresses up as Santa Claus and goes out to deliver all the presents, but all the presents are, like, terrorizing people because they're Halloween presents. Santa Claus is, like, kidnapped by the boogeyman who's, like, trying to kill him, just, like, cuz, I guess. The boogeyman's just a dick for no reason.
Yeah.
And there's a whole romantic subplot about this ragdoll girl named Sally who's super into Jack, and she's like, clearly the path you're going on is not going to end well.
Maybe stealing another person's holiday is not a good idea.
I know, Sally's the only person who thinks in Halloween time.
Plot twist. Turns out Jack Skellington was a colonialist the whole time.
Pretty much. So then the movie ends with Jack realizing he's wrong, and he goes and he saves Santa Claus and Sally from the boogeyman, and then he's like, yo, Santa Claus, I'm sorry I fucked up your holiday. And Santa's like, it's cool, I'll fix it, but don't be a dick again. And then the movie ends with Santa Claus like flying by in a sleigh and saying Merry Christmas and snow falls, and then the rest of the citizens of Halloween Town are kind of understanding Jack's excitement now. So it ends with like Jack's now reinvigorated to go do Halloween the best he can again. But he got what he wanted. He got away from his holiday for a little while.
He got a little vacation.
Yep. And yeah, that's pretty much it. The reason that I wanted to rep it for this is because, like, there's lots of scary shit that we can be focusing on, but there are scary moments in Over the Garden Walls, but really I just find it kind of charming, and it's charming because it takes on that whole creepy aesthetic, and I think that a movie to some degree or another by Tim Burton is greatly exemplary of that.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that neither Nightmare Before Christmas or Over the Garden Wall are horror.
Yeah, no, they're just
they're horror influenced, but not actually horror. And
they're not horror, they're just appreciating scary and creepy things as like an aesthetic, and so I thought it would be a good thing to rep.
All right. Right, Eddie. Halloween 3, the Night of the Witches thingy.
The Witches thingy. Halloween witches 3, thingy. The Witches thingy.
Halloween 3, which title is it?
Oh, fuck off.
Don't fucking bring that shit into my house. Anyway, I'm going to be repping Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. A film that, there we go. A lot of people either don't know exists or forget about. So let's get into it. Halloween 3 Season of the Witch is the third film in the Halloween franchise, most well known for its main character, Michael Myers, serial killer, murderer.
Yeah, he's the guy from Austin Powers, right?
Yeah, so long ago in a dark decade called the 1970s. John Carpenter created a film called Halloween.
Dude goes around killing people. That's Halloween.
Yeah, it was the most successful indie film of all time until it was unseated 21 years later by the Blair Witch Project. They ended up making a sequel that John Carpenter wrote but did not direct called Halloween 2. And then the studio was like, hey, John Carpenter, these films have been very successful. Let's do Halloween 3, buddy. And John Carpenter was like, no, I'm not doing it. And they were like, fine, we're doing it without you, kid. And then John Carpenter was like, fuck, they're gonna ruin my shit. All right, fine, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And then he was like, but what if we don't do another Michael Myers film? Because I'm not some pandering hack. I'm an artist. What if instead we turn Halloween into an anthology series? Every year on Halloween, we'll release a film in the Halloween series with a different story that takes place on or around the holiday of Halloween. And the studio somehow was like, sure, John, let's do it. I don't know what kind of magic he had, but he had some. Maybe that's why it's called Season of the Witch.
The witch is actually just John Carpenter.
So Halloween 3 has nothing to do with Michael Myers. Instead, there's this Irish witch.
Okay.
Who is it's like Connell Cochran or something like that. Anyway,
I'll Google it.
Yeah, he owns a company that makes like Halloween costumes. What he has done this spoopy Halloween is he's combined his ancient Irish witch magic with modern in 1983, I think. 1982, I'm sorry, I lied. With modern technology. So he's got these robots and shit like that. Anyway, he's got these Halloween masks. There's a witch, and there's a pumpkin, and there's a skeleton. Crazy, creative, exciting masks. And they have these microchips in them that have this, like, magic hex on them.
Magic and science? That's crazy.
on Halloween night, he'll send out this like signal that all the microchips will pick up, and that signal has like the second part of the hex in it. So anyone wearing one of the masks will get hexed, and their face will melt under the mask, and they'll turn into like worms and snakes and stuff.
Okay.
Pretty evil plan. He's killing all these children, right? So Tom Atkins, he's like a detective or something, I don't know. He's like, I gotta get to the bottom of this, figure out what's going on, right? This is fishy. And then there's this lady, Ellie. She's helping Tom Atkins. Tom Atkins is an actor. I don't know his character's name. She's helping him. But then we find out at the end of the movie, she was a robot the whole time.
Aw, snap.
Bum, bum,
bum. Witch robot.
Top 10 anime betrayals.
There's fucking witches and robots and not Michael Myers. It's crazy.
Yeah.
If only the international spy were here to help everyone.
Oh, I get it.
Here's the thing. Maybe I didn't do a great job at describing the film, but it is a fantastic little film. But at the time it came out, people are sitting in the theater, they're watching it, they're like, what the fuck does this have to do with Michael Myers? And then they got to the end of the movie, and they're like, where the fuck was Michael Myers?
Yeah.
So people were mad. They didn't like the film, didn't make a lot of money. Almost killed the Halloween series. Actually did kill it for about 7 or 8 years. Until Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, came out, in which, in the marketing, they made it blatantly clear that, yes, Michael Myers is in this one. We're sorry.
Yeah, baby.
But here's the thing. The only thing that is bad about Halloween 3, Season of the Witch is the word Halloween in its title.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, if they made that movie second instead of...
It would have been received a little bit better.
Yeah.
But, it's a great movie. It's a real good Halloween spook fest. I recommend everybody right now pause the podcast, go damn. Watch Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, and then come on back.
I would recommend you watch Over the Garden Wall first, but...
No, they already watched that, Tom Wolf.
Yeah, we had them pause earlier.
Yeah.
Come on.
Anyways, Pat, it's your turn. Tell us about Pan's Labyrinth.
All right, so Pan's Labyrinth is the story of a girl who cried a river and drowned the whole world. Not really, but...
While she looked so sad in photographs.
I absolutely love her.
I absolutely love her.
When she smiles.
When she smiles.
Good luck syncing that one up.
So how it's many a story... days in a year,
shut
man.
Up, shut up, shut up. It's time to actually get serious. So, Pan's Labyrinth is the story of a girl named Ophelia. She and her mother, who is currently
her boyfriend
pregnant,
Hamlet.
She and her mother, who is currently pregnant with the Satan spawn of some asshole Spanish war officer guy, Vidal, I think his name is, they move out in the middle of the woods. He is an asshole, and he very clearly only cares about this son so that he has, like...
An heir, yeah.
Doesn't care about Ophelia at all. Doesn't, like, only marginally cares about his new girlfriend, wife, person. Ophelia, when she moves out into the woods with this guy.
Into the unknown?
Shut up.
Discovers a labyrinth of sorts. Later, she gets contacted by this thing, which looks like a half goat, half man, which is like a fawn, I guess is what that's called.
Yeah.
Yeah, she gets contacted by this fawn who says, you are the ancient princess Moana, not that Moana, from the...
Moana, Moana. Man, that makes Pan's Labyrinth a very different movie.
Yeah. So, what can I say except you're welcome, but...
I'm gonna need that boat.
So, Pan is the name of the fawn, which is, like, kind of shoehorned in there, but...
Well, isn't Pan, like, a... Like, Pan the fawn is, like, a thing from fairy tales, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, he's a Greek demigod known to travelers for, like, letting out a blood-curdling scream and then killing them and eating them and possibly raping them, so...
Yeah, so it's not a really good analogy, because Pan doesn't do any of that in this, but he does give Ophelia a bunch of tasks. He gives her 3 tasks, to be specific, in order to unlock the center of the labyrinth and join her ancient kingdom.
She needs a golden comb.
It takes place during World War II, so It follows kind of the story of also the rebellion in Spain fighting back against, I guess, Vidal and his men, who are the assholes in this story. The antagonists, if you prefer.
Astagonists.
So it follows that story. So you get these two stories of, like, the real world and all the horror that's going on there, and then this little girl's escape into fairy tale land. So it's a little different than Over the Garden Wall, because they do kind of like throw some fairy tale stuff in there, but it's not like super blatant Hansel and Gretel kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's very much more meant to be a parable than a fairy tale. And that parable, which is something that's supposed to like teach you something, is that you should not believe in fairy tales. So throughout the story, she goes and does these tasks that Pan has told her to do, one of which is go get a key from the inside of a frog. He gives her some stones to feed to the frog, who then pukes up this key.
This sounds like a point-and-click adventure game.
Yeah, it's kind of lame, but she goes and she brings the key back to her room, and then Pan comes back and says, all right, I need you to go take this chalk, go in and get this dagger from this place, but be careful, do not eat any of the food from the feast that you're about to see, or else you're gonna die.
And then she fucking eats the food.
So then she goes down there, she's got these fairies with her, and then all of a sudden she notices this weird creepy thing sitting at the head of the table, and he's not moving. She goes over and pops a grape in her mouth, because she's a fucking kid and doesn't understand the consequences of her actions.
Same.
Then weird crazy guy starts to get up, and you see that his face has no eyes, but his hands have slots. He puts his hands on a table. There's a plate there. They've got eyeballs on the plate. He puts those eyeballs in his hand. He puts it up against his face, and he's just like walking around all creepy like with his hands, and then
fucking Doug Jones.
He eats two of the fairies that's with her, and then she's just like, all right, fuck, I'm dipping. Grabs a fairy. They start running. They get out. Pan is just like, dude, what the fuck? I told you not to eat any of the food. I don't know if you're actually Moana anymore. You're gonna have to prove yourself.
You have to go find the heart of Tahiti
in 3 days when the full moon is. So then the full moon comes, and there's a whole bunch of other shit that happens. Her mom dies but gives birth to this kid, the son of Vidal, who's his heir. And at the same time, the rebellion starts to close in on Vidal. So in the process, she drugs Vidal, takes the heir to the center of the labyrinth, because Pan told her she has to take the infant boy to the center of the labyrinth. And then when she gets there, after outrunning Vidal, Pan says, you need to spill some blood in order to go back to your kingdom. She's like, no, I will not spill the blood of this boy. He did nothing wrong. It's not okay. And then all of a sudden, Vidal comes up right behind her, because he's had all this time to catch up, takes the son and shoots her in the stomach and leaves her there to bleed out. In the process, that bloodshed from an innocent, even though she wasn't really that innocent, if we're being honest, she ate the fucking grape, dude. She deserved it. So
how dare she?
She gets shot in the stomach, and then in the process, that opens up the labyrinth, and she goes back to her kingdom. So she's like, she's dead, but now she's in a purgatory type, like, heaven kind of weird thing.
And, dear listeners, the entire movie is in Spanish.
Yeah, it's a Guillermo del Toro movie, so it's in Spanish, and the visuals are creepy as fuck, but it's fan-fucking-tastic. You should pause right now and go watch it.
Yes.
So many commercial breaks in this episode.
Yeah, happy Halloween, listeners.
Don't worry, we'll wait for you.
I hate you.
All right, we're good.
All right. Anyways, let us move on to the spooky discussion.
So much spoop.
So much spoop. Let's go in reverse order. So, Pat.
What? Okay.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Mixing it up.
We're about to discuss all the fuck out of this bitch.
Anyways, Pat.
Yes.
So, a similarity I noticed between Pan's Labyrinth and Over the Garden Wall is that, in a way, they're both coming-of-age stories about their respective main characters, you know?
Indeed.
Except the age Ophelia comes to is death.
Yeah.
And my question to you is, why is it that something creepy and something scary works so well with coming-of-age?
Well, I think that just goes back to when we were kids and we thought there were monsters in our closets, right? Like,
right.
That's true.
When you're a kid, the unknown and, like, everything that is different to you in the world is a little bit scary. And then once you grow up, you start to, like, learn that it's not all that bad. However, in Ophelia's case, she didn't really get to grow up to the sense that she could realize that things weren't all that bad, because she had the ultimate evil of her stepfather that was, like, a real-life thing, like a real-life evil. All the other evil she could overcome, all the fairy tales and things in her mind she could get over, but the one real-life threat is the thing that ended up killing her. So it's kind of pessimistic in that.
It's actually interesting the two things are actually on opposite dichotomies, where Ophelia was ultimately killed by reality. Wirt was able to use his experience in the unknown to face reality.
Well, I think she kind of uses her labyrinth tasks to face reality too, because it's the only thing that she really does besides talk to her maid person.
She doesn't really have much of a life outside of that, right? Because of the wartime and shit.
The wartime and the fact that her stepfather hates her, and like there's nobody around there that's her age. She just goes off and explores, and it ends up killing her, which is really sad.
Yeah, but fuck her, right? Because she ate a grape.
She ate the fucking grape, man.
She had it coming.
I mean, if she had just spilled that blood a little bit faster, she might have been able to, like, not die and get shot in the fucking stomach, but...
I mean...
Are you saying she should have killed her brother? I'm saying
she had no reason to care about that kid.
What? Hold up. Wait the fuck up. You think that Ophelia is guilty because she ate a grape, but she's stupid for not killing an infant just because it meant nothing to her?
She was already guilty, dude.
She had already eaten the grape at this point.
She was already guilty.
She is God.
So she might as well go around slaughtering orphans.
Dude, she's down the slippery slope, okay? It's just a matter of how fast she's gonna slide.
Yeah.
Remember, kids, don't do grapes. They lead down the devil's path.
She also drugged somebody, dude. That's fucked.
Okay, but the only thing you cited was eating a fucking grape.
Hey, you two robbers. You're under arrest. Just kidding. Happy Halloween.
Another thing that I also want to draw a comparison to, though, is that Ophelia is also played by Elijah Wood.
Oh, yeah. How did I forget that?
I must have missed that. She's not.
You know what I fucking realized, guys?
What?
Elijah Wood, you know, the beast's trying to turn him into Edelwood. It's Elijah Edelwood. You know what I'm saying?
Yep. Motherfucker! I'm mad that I didn't come up with that.
But, like, I guess I could talk a little bit more about the reason why I chose Pan's Labyrinth.
Why did you choose Pan's Labyrinth?
Yeah, go ahead.
Honestly, the thing that stuck out to me most was the whole giving tasks to achieve some sort of end goal.
See, Pat had an ulterior motive by trying real hard to get that part of episode 10 summarized.
That's why I said I needed that in there so I could talk about it. Yeah. So the Beast gives Greg these goals to save Wirt's soul. The tasks in Over the Garden Wall are a lot more asinine, and it just goes along with the whole, like, kind of more casual theme of that.
Well, I think, like, the point of, like, Greg's task wasn't so much to prove himself or anything. I think the Beast was just doing that to, like, break Greg's spirit.
Yeah.
I think that the first two tasks were totally irrelevant. I think that he just told them to do those tasks so that
to pass the time until the sun sets.
Yeah, he was just building up to the last task, because the last task, trying to catch the sun, means that Greg has to sit there staring at a cup and thus falls asleep in the winter.
Yeah.
Like, I think the point of the tasks was the Beast was just trying to trick him into falling asleep.
Just gotta wait.
Yes. Just sit there in the cold and wait.
The point was to try to, like, tire him out and make him stay in the blizzard
that was
clearly going to freeze him to death. Yes.
The way I read it was that he was trying to take up time so that the Edelwood branches could envelop Elijah Wood.
No, I think the point of putting Wirt in the Edelwood was to get Greg to offer his soul up, because the Heavenly Woman in Greg's dream episode... You know,
The,
like, fancy, like, fucking Schoolhouse Rock-ish cartoon episode with Greg's dream that ends with him getting a wish from this mystical cloud lady.
Schoolhouse Rock. It clearly looked like a early Fleischer cartoon kind of thing, you know, Felix the Cat.
Yeah. I think of those as the same kind of, you know.
Looked exactly like Schoolhouse Rock. There was a bill.
Yeah.
And an owl.
Anyway, the woman at the end of that, I think, is suggested to be the Beast.
Yeah.
Like, the lady in the tavern said, don't believe his lies. The obvious play is to try to get Wirt, because Wirt's down on his soul, so he's playing around that and trying to get Greg instead.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think what he was trying to do was, like, get Greg so exhausted that, like...
that he falls asleep in the blizzard, and then he can turn him to a tree, yeah.
Yeah.
So, additionally, I think that Pan's tasks were designed to get Ophelia to fuck up somehow. I think Pan is the Beast in, like, Pan's Labyrinth. I think Pan gives her these tasks to try to, like, prove that not everybody is innocent. Like, she gets the first one done just fine, but then she disobeys the not eating the grapes, just like Adam and Eve eating the fruit from the forbidden tree in the Bible.
Or like Charlie in the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, so I think Pan was being a trickster, and as fawns are known to try to eat people, I think he was trying to lure her soul down into the labyrinth, which is like, I guess, a trap. That's what labyrinths are designed to do, and trap her soul there and feed off of her youth and like energy and goodness to make himself live forever. That was my theory about this whole thing.
So he lurks out there in the unknown?
Yeah.
Looking for those who are far from home. Hoping never to let you return.
You better beware. Ooh, the beast is out there. Ooh, better be wise
and don't believe his lies. Can we just also take a minute to talk about how Greg has the most disgusting taste in potatoes? Who the fuck puts molasses on potatoes? That is disgusting.
It's great. It's all he had to work with, you know?
It's disgusting.
Potatoes and molasses.
All right, that's all I had.
Anyways, Eddie. So much like how Over the Garden Wall has its aesthetic around things that are considered Halloween-y, you know, and the Halloween 3, the whole plot is revolving around this one witch's belief that Halloween has been stolen and commodified into something capitalistic.
Bro, did you read a wiki? Or have you seen Halloween 3 Season of the Witch?
Maybe he's just smart, Eddie.
I have seen Halloween
3. Oh, shit. Tell me you've seen it?
I've seen it, yeah.
Bro.
Bonding moment.
I'm so excited.
Yeah. Bro, high five for Halloween 3.
Tamu, I'm sorry. That took me aback. I was like, whoa, someone else has seen this movie. All right, anyway, go on with the question.
Anyway, so both are about the Halloween aesthetic. And I guess what I want to ask you is, what's so enjoyable about that Halloween aesthetic?
Well, here's the thing. I think most people, not everybody, but most people in our culture do have a positive association with that aesthetic because, you know, we first encounter Halloween as children and they give us free candy.
Spoop is fun, man.
Which is actually a pretty interesting dichotomy that, like, we always watch scary stuff or tell scary stories or dress up as scary stuff on Halloween, but it's like this happy time for everybody, you know, like it makes light of all the stuff that could be considered scary,
yeah.
Which is actually something that I think Over the Garden Wall and cartoons like it do really well, where they take, you know, some of this like spooky imagery and themes and they make it cartoony and fun.
It's like creepy in a comedic sort of sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or like you have in the one episode of Over the Garden Wall, you have these like creepy pumpkin cult dudes, or at least that's how Greg and Wirt see them. But then at the end, it turns out they're just having a party.
Yeah, they're pretty high.
What do you mean? It turns out that they're dead the whole time.
Oh yeah, well they were
skeletons inside of pumpkins.
Yeah, they're living skeletons inside of pumpkins. Yeah.
Yeah, but they're like all paranoid that they're gonna like kill them the whole time.
Yeah, but they're not trying to kill them at all.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. You know.
I sentence you to
a few hours of manual labor.
And murder. We didn't murder anyone.
Oh no, not murder, but those other crimes.
All right, but anyway, so an interesting thing that Halloween 3 Season of the Witch does is kind of takes that idea and does turn it on its head a little bit, because the masks in the film are these really like simple masks. They're not like elaborate or like crazy cool looking. It's just a jack-o'-lantern mask and a skeleton mask and a witch mask. They're all super simple, basic, right?
Right.
They're masks that you could actually buy in the real world. And yeah, sure, maybe there's not witches and stuff, but someone could do something to these masks with science, with technology. It's the 80s. You don't understand technology yet. And so it kind of takes what would be considered a non-scary thing and makes it, you know, a little unsettling. So I think that is a really interesting comparison to draw.
Yeah, and as a quick follow-up, why do we enjoy being scared? We intentionally, like, watch things that creep us out, and normally that's considered an emotion you want to avoid. You don't want to be scared.
I don't know that, like, I agree. I'm not saying that that doesn't exist. And to answer that question specifically, I think it's about the kind of thrill of it.
Gets the blood pumping.
I would not say that that is the reason that one would go and watch something like Over the Garden Walls.
No, but like when people watch Over the Garden Wall and like get creeped out at some part, they derive joy from
it. Yeah. But here's what I'm getting at here is that like with Over the Garden Walls and like Nightmare Before Christmas, it's not really trying to scare people. It's creeping them out, but it's in an enjoyable sort of way.
Right.
Like, I think that it's like a very specific stylistic aesthetic that some people just appreciate. And like, one more time, what's his name? Who made Over the Garden Walls?
Eddie.
Patrick McHale.
Patrick McHale.
Yeah, Patrick McHale.
Like, I think that's just an aesthetic that he personally likes. And it's the same kind of thing with Tim Burton. But I don't think that people are drawn to that for the same area of reasoning that they're drawn to watch horror movies. You know what I mean?
So, Tom, well, let me answer the question that you asked. The reason we like being scared.
I mentioned that for the thrill. I'm just saying I don't think that it's necessarily the case that you watch Over the Garden Walls to get scared. You know what I mean?
I totally agree.
I mean, yeah, I don't watch Pan's Labyrinth to get scared. I just watch it because his style is so cool.
Yeah, like, that's what I'm saying.
The aesthetic is insane.
So I think that the reason we like being scared is it kind of diffuses the whole notion of fear. When we put it in a recreational setting, it does have that thrilling factor to it where it gets the blood pumping, but it diffuses the scary things, you know?
I would argue that's the opposite, Eddie. I think that people are smiling and laughing, making jokes about it to diffuse the horror from their memory so that they don't get scared.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I like watching scary movies because it gets my heart pounding. Like, it gets the adrenaline up and I'm just like, holy shit, what's going to happen? And then afterwards, I look for any excuse to not be scared anymore.
So the interesting thing connecting Nightmare Before Christmas and Over the Garden Wall is that they actually have some similar influences with each other.
Yeah.
Kitschy Americana, 19th century folk art. So just talk about that.
Yeah, sure. I think that both of those influences are really great because the way that both Nightmare Before Christmas and Over the Garden Walls take them is they kind of just shove them through the roof.
Mm.
They push it way in that direction so that when you go and you see a scene like in episode 9 of Over the Garden Walls where they're back in their real world, it's such a shift that it makes you notice everything you've been watching so much more. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like all the music changes to a different aesthetic because the unknown seems to be taking place like the aesthetic of the area looks a lot older than the time that they actually live in. It looks kind of like 90s-ish in the real world, vaguely.
Yeah.
What The Nightmare Before Christmas does, they actually set it up so these worlds are very different. You know, they have a specific Christmas world and Halloween world in the real world, right? And you see that a lot in the aesthetics, and you can like limit it to color palettes. Like I watched the DVD commentary, and it's something like the palette for Halloween Town was limited to like black, gray, yellow, and like orange, pretty much, right?
Right.
Whereas Christmas Town is full of lots of pretty colors, and the real world is mostly neutral tones, drab. Like gray, yeah. And I feel like we see that same kind of thing in episode 9 of Over the Garden Walls when we get our flashback and see Greg and Wirt in the real world. It doesn't have the same flavor as the world of the unknown, basically.
Yeah, one reason I enjoy that kind of aesthetic is that it opens up possibilities and you get to see new ideas and new concepts open up from the style, and that's always a good time.
Yeah, definitely.
It's always a good time.
I think that wraps up our discussion.
Go watch Halloween 3 Season of the Witch.
Don't worry. We'll wait.
Yeah, go watch Nightmare Before Christmas. God damn it.
Indeed. So, let's move on to the ratings section.
Rating section. It's the rating section.
That'll go great with the music already playing in the background.
Are we rating the quality of Eddie's voice? Because I give that a 5 out of 7. Perfect score.
Thanks, man. Wow.
I give it a 12 out of 4.5.
Oh my god. You guys. Should I go be on American Idol?
Shut up, Chatter.
So, in the rating section, each of our reps will rate Over the Garden Wall a rating out of 5. After that, I will then give what is essentially a gold star to whoever I feel did the best in this podcast. For this episode, there are 5 bowls of mashed potatoes and
molasses.
What you're going to do
molasses?
Is decide how many molasses go on those
How many bowls of mashed potatoes get molasses?
Pashed potatoes.
Yeah. Pashed potatoes.
Pashed potatoes.
The hash slinging slasher.
The sash bringing. The crash zinging.
The molasses bringing.
Smasher.
Anyways.
How much molasses goes on them potatoes?
Yeah. So, Jeff.
Yes.
How many bowls of potatoes get glasses?
All right, guys. All right. It's time. We're ready. We're doing it. 5 out of 5. This is my 5 out of 5. I love Over the Garden Walls. 5 out of 5 molasses on them potatoes. I watched this show pretty much all in one sitting when I finally decided to watch it, and it was so good. This, for the podcast, was my 3rd time seeing it, and especially watching it multiple times, you start to notice just, like, how much incredible foreshadowing happens, and, like, there's so many details. Literally, the events of the entire show are pretty much summed up in the opening sequence of the first episode.
Snap.
It's crazy. So, 5 out of 5 potatoes. With molasses. 5 out of 5 molasses for them potatoes.
All right. Eddie, how many bowls of potatoes get molasses?
I think I've given this rating before, but I don't have a great memory. So this may be the first time, but probably isn't. I'm going to have to give Over the Garden Wall 5 bowls of potatoes with molasses on them.
That is 10 bowls of potatoes with molasses for those of you keeping count.
Boy, did I enjoy that. It's fun. It's got a great aesthetic. It's a little creepy. It is episodic, and each episode has its own interesting plot that keeps you entertained while at the same time keeping this overarching plot going.
Yeah.
Well, I enjoyed the heck out of it, and I wanted to keep watching. At the same time, it wrapped up so nicely and had such a good ending that I don't want more of it. I definitely will probably watch the series again, but I'm glad that it has an ending, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Yeah, all around real great. 5 out of 5. Good choice, Temple.
Nice. All right, Patrick.
So, before I say this...
just gonna give it a 1.
I would like to preface it with the fact that to me... a better rating would be fewer potatoes with molasses on it because I don't want the fucking molasses on my potatoes. But I have to give this motherfucker a 5 out of 5.
Oh, shit. That's a perfect 15. I think that's the first time that it's ever happened.
So the reason why I gave it a 5 out of 5 is because A, it was hysterical. Like, Greg is the greatest person of all time in any animated show. I love Greg so much.
I love his huge eyes. Like, they're somehow huge and beady at the same time.
I like that he's wearing a teapot on his head.
A teapot on top of his head?
You just don't question that he's wearing a teapot until it's explained to you.
Dude, episode 9 blew my mind, okay? When it was revealed that he's not just wearing a teapot, that that's an elephant costume, I was like, oh my god. Fucking M. Night Shyamalan level twist.
It's just all around a great story, and I'm gonna go ahead and say I wish it were longer. I wish I had more of it. It's just, every single character has so much to offer, except maybe a couple of the frogs that never talk, but that's it.
I like the frogs.
Everybody else, Sarah has stuff to offer. What's his stupid name?
Jason Thunderburger.
Jason Thunderburger. And of course, we always have to specify which Jason Thunderburger, because...
the other one is just a frog.
That's the other one.
That was a pretty good impression.
Yeah.
That was pretty good.
Thanks, man. I moonlight as a frog impersonator, so...
oh, shit.
I try my hardest. I think now it's time for Taimul to tell us which one of us did the best. And I called you Taimul this time because you're calling me Patrick, so I feel like we're being super formal.
Yes. This episode's gold star will be the spoopiest gold star of them all. The Golden Thunderburger.
Yes.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Do you believe in ghosts?
Why?
Because there's one right behind you. I'm just kidding.
It's okay, Thunderburger.
Guys, we didn't talk about rock facts at all.
I know.
Oh my god.
That's a rock fact.
How did we not? Fuck.
Hey, Wart, wanna learn some rock facts?
I stole this.
I'm a stealer, and that's a rock fact.
Alright, so who's the winner?
Oh my god, the leaves are growing inside him.
No, I was just eating leaves.
It's so good. It's so good.
Greg. Okay. I'm good. Collect yourself.
Anyways, the one who wins the Golden Thunderburger is...
Al! You fucking asshole. That was so loud.
Jeffrey Levitt.
Thank you! Oh, I've never wanted something so much in my entire life than the Golden Thunderburger. I'm so proud. Thank you, Chowder.
That was rigged. I demand a recount.
I'm sorry, Jeff was on top of that.
Yeah, I know there were one whole votes, but can you recount them for Pat's sake?
Oh, God.
Okay, I'll check. Yeah, it was Jeffrey
Levitt. Oh, my God.
Okay, I concede.
Okay, for my acceptance speech, I would just really like to say... Thanks, Chowder.
And for my defeat speech, I'd like
Yo,
to
shut
say
the fuck up. Get the
that
fuck
Over the Garden
here.
Wall was really
for
good.
My acceptance speech,
so
I'm just
going to
talk
Labyrinth,
over Eddie the entire
so
time.
The Nightmare
I don't
Before
want
Christmas.
Any of words.
But
of
most
his
of
fucking
all,
bullshit.
Halloween 3, Season
oh
of the Witch
God,
was great. And
you
should all
I
go watch
you.
It right now. Pause the podcast. Watch Halloween
shut
3,
up,
Season
Eddie.
Of the Witch.
Alright, so, outro read. The moon hides behind the clouds. The night hates darkness eternal. And this week's topic was Over the Garden Wall. You can check it out on Hulu. Our next episode will be hosted by...
Pat.
Oh, hey! Nice. We're going to be talking about Westworld.
It's a great show.
We're going to talk about its use of nudity and profanity and how it conveys people being less than human.
Oh, shit.
If any of you listening want to contact us, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Geeking Program, or email us at commongeekingprogram@gmail.com. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, leave a review. It's a great way for more people to find our show.
Leave a review.
As is recommending us to... as is recommending us to friends. If you want to know more, go to commongeekingprogram.com. And that's a rock pack.
Ain't that just the way?
There's clarinet and poetry on there. Clarinet and poetry!
This episode of the Common Geeking Program was hosted by Taimul Chowdhury, or Chowder, whichever you prefer, joined by Jeff Levitt, Edward Ryan, and Patrick Brem. This episode is sponsored by Commercial Breaks. Don't worry, we'll wait. The podcast is created and produced by Colin Ketchin and Jeff Levitt, with this episode edited by me, Jeff, and featuring original music by Colin Ketchin. If you like this show, follow us, tell your friends, or leave a review. We hope you tune in for our next episode on November 3rd, and thank you for listening to this.
All right, listeners, dear listeners, Taimul Chowder, our erstwhile host, is just a floating ball of light.
He's a glowing orb in the sky
he's
right
now. He's a glowing orb. That's a great way to describe it. He's a glowing orb.
Good evening.
Oh my god.
Gentle folk.
Jesus Christ. This is Dude, quite the spooked. Elaborate setup for this audio podcast, Chowder. Oh, it's horrifying.
But your webcam has to slow down its frame rate so much just so it can get enough light to get your face in. It's like the choppiest thing I've ever seen. It's hilarious.
Dude, it adds to the effect.
It's pretty okay.
It's a little creepy.
Right.
Yeah, I like it. Like, it's just a little bit slow. Like, it's maybe 10 frames under.
Yeah.
Like, it's in the uncanny valley of frame rates.
It's like looking at a Rorschach test, but it's actually just Chowder's face. We gotta take a screenshot here.
You're like, oh, this Rorschach test looks like Chowder. And then the Rorschach test is like, whatever you prefer.